Please be seated. We are here in the matter of North Main versus District Court, real party interest being Aspen Financial, case number 58452. Mr. Morris, you're ready to proceed?
I am, just to say that this time, Aaron Morris, on behalf of the petitioners. We filed a petition with this court seeking a writ of mandamus, directing Judge Denton to vacate his order, compelling my clients to, or a number of my clients, to submit their claims to our arbitration because a review of the actual arbitration provisions in their loan servicing agreements reveal they were not executed by Aspen. I don't think there's any dispute in Nevada that the question of whether an enforceable agreement to arbitrate exists rests in basic contract principles. We've provided this court with cases out of California, mainly because in California they actually require an arbitration provision take pretty much the exact form of the arbitration provision at issue in this case, so it's easy to draw parallels. Those courts, specifically the Marcus and Millichap case and the Phillips case, they find that the execution of the arbitration provision by one party constitutes an offer by that party to submit any future disputes to binding arbitration, and execution of that arbitration provision by the second party would constitute acceptance of that offer. Therefore, if one party initials the arbitration provision and the other party does not, that actually constitutes the rejection of an offer to arbitrate. We pointed this court to a number of cases out of this jurisdiction, specifically the Keddie versus Beneficial Insurance case, where this court made it clear that all contracts, quote, require a manifestation of mutual assent in the form of an offer by one party and acceptance thereof by the other. We also directed this court to the Jim L. Shitake's Distributing Company, Inc. versus Centel Communications Company case, and that's the case that provides, quote, if, quote, a particular manner of contract formation is contemplated by the parties, a binding contract is not formed in the absence of compliance with the contemplated procedure.
Leads me to a question, because we're here on a writ. How much of a record was developed below with respect to the intent of the parties as it relates to the arbitration provision?
Well, fortunately, well, the answer is none. There was no investigation by the court, no evidentiary hearing, nothing of that sort with respect to the intent of the parties because, well, I guess I need to make sure I'm clear. That was not something that my office believed was even relevant with respect to the examination. If you look at the case law, you know, the simple fact is if you have an arbitration provision that provides for a specific form of a manifestation of assent, in this case, which we do, where it's, you know, the arbitration provision we quoted over and over again, you know, by initialing in the space below, you were agreeing to have any dispute arising out of the matters included in this paragraph decided by neutral arbitration. Go down to the next sentence. By initialing in the space below, you're giving up your judicial rights to discovery. And then right above the two initial blocks, it says, we have read and understood the foregoing and agree to submit disputes arising out of the matters included in this paragraph to neutral arbitration. Signed by my clients, not signed by Aspen. The way we framed the issue was, you know, can a party who refuses or declines to sign or initial an arbitration provision nonetheless enforce that against a party who does? The cases out of California have great public policy discussions. They go into they go at length to the reason, because in those cases you have a situation where the party who refused to sign or failed to sign comes to court and says, This was just an oversight. We meant to do this. We want to have this submitted to arbitration. You know, you need to listen to our testimony with regard to the intent of the parties. And in those cases, the California courts say, you know what? If we allow that, it's going to be the slippery slope. You're going to have a situation where why would anybody ever initial an arbitration provision? Because by refusing to initial the arbitration provision, you'd be reserving, they use the phrase, you know, you'd have your cake and eat it too. You could pick and choose, you know, depending upon this dispute, do you want to arbitrate it?
Counsel, comment about Campanella, which is a Nevada case from 1970, as to a single signature, dual signatures not required?
Well, that wasn't with respect to an arbitration agreement, correct? Because the case that we look at is the Roth versus Scott case from 1996, which dealt with an unsigned arbitration agreement. I think that case is far more on point with regard to the need to have both signatures. That case deals with an unsigned arbitration agreement. The court engaged. It's not as dead on in terms of facts as the Marcus and Millichap case and the Phillips case out of California.
So you would not consider our 1970 opinion in Campanelli?
I would believe. I wouldn't want to say that I would not consider it at all. What I would say is the 1996 decision of this court makes it clear that this court agrees that the execution by one party of a provision like this in an offer which does not result in acceptance of that offer through execution of that agreement doesn't give you an agreement to arbitrate. And I think if this court wants to go to the kind of the touchy-feely analysis that I think that the real parties in interest want to use, which is let's set up a hearing, let me bring Jeff Quinn in, Jeff Quinn's going to say, I meant to sign those. The California courts looked at that and said, we don't even want to deal with that. It's not that hard to require manifestation of assent as required in the specific document. I mean, and you look at one of these, you look at the petitioners that are actually involved. One of the documents, if you go to, it's in the appendix, it is the loan servicing agreement that is, starts on page 588 of the appendix. This is the loan servicing agreement for Charles Barrup and Bernadine Barrup. These are two people who Judge Denton has ordered to submit their claims to arbitration. You move forward to page 595 of that loan servicing agreement, and you see the exact situation you have with all the other petitioners. Whereas Mr. and Mrs. Barrup initialed it, nobody from Aspen did. Now, this is a party that has been compelled to arbitrate. On behalf of the petitioners, the question has to be asked, well, how did Aspen signify its consent to or its acceptance of the Barracks' offer to arbitrate? I mean, the agreement provides that you're going to initial below to signify your consent.
But other documents were signed in the course of the process, correct?
Pardon?
Were any other documents signed in the course of the process? Let me rephrase. Were any documents similar to the loan servicing agreement here that you're referencing signed, executed by the Aspen defendants?
I do not know. And, in fact, the reason why I pointed the court to this one is because if you go back to – because what Aspen seems to be arguing is, well, we didn't initial the arbitration provisions, but we signed the agreements, mm-hmm. not this one. If you go back to page 597, nobody for Aspen signed this agreement at all. So you have an agreement here. The Barracks have been compelled to arbitrate by Judge Denton. And you have a situation where the arbitration provision that says – by initialing below, we are agreeing to submit our claims to arbitrate, is not initialed by Aspen, and you have a loan servicing agreement that's not initialed by Aspen. I don't see anything in this document that tells me that Aspen agreed to submit any claims to arbitration. And I want you, you got to put it in the context of this case. The initial, well, it was the first amended complaint. There was no request by Aspen to arbitrate.
You didn't raise in the court below or in this writ, an argument that the assertion of arbitration was untimely.
Well, that's correct. I'm not raising that argument.
It was waived.
No. It was, well, no, that's not correct, Justice Horsey. That was the whole basis for the argument at the district court level. Judge Denton rejected that. What he found was,
you haven't raised that issue in this writ.
Correct. What I'm doing is pointing out why this is a slippery slope. Okay. That's all I'm doing is showing why this is a slippery slope.
I was wondering why we were going down the untimely and waiver point.
Because what happened here?
It's not asserted in this writ.
I'm not arguing it. Correct. I am not making the argument that is untimely. What I am talking about is essentially venue shopping. The first complaint's filed a day after we file a first amended complaint to correct a few dates. That's the operative pleading for, I think, a year, maybe more. Information comes to light. We file a motion to move to amend the complaint. That motion is opposed, but it's granted. We file the amended complaint. They make a renewed request for arbitration. We say no, it's untimely at that point. They file a motion to compel arbitration, and we go to battle over that issue. Judge Denton agreed with them. He said the new pleading changed the nature of the case. Therefore, they now it gives rise to a new right on their part to request arbitration. The point I'm raising is, by not signing the arbitration provision, the Aspen parties essentially reserve that ability to venue shop, to pick and choose against which of the parties to their loan servicing agreement they want to litigate with in the courts or which they want to litigate in arbitration. I mean, think about if this were otherwise. If my clients had not signed the arbitration provision and their clients had signed the arbitration provision, I mean, technically, both parties stand on equal footing.
But you're pointing out a consequence, Mr. Morris.
Pardon?
You're pointing out a consequence.
Correct.
That has nothing to do with the question of whether it's an enforceable provision in the contract based on the intent of the parties at the time it's signed. Maybe your argument would be better focused on the point you raised in the writ.
Well, the courts in California, when they have looked at this issue, the reason they are unwilling, as Justice Seda said, just to say to ask the question about whether there was an evidentiary hearing at the lower court level to determine whether what the parties truly intended. I answered no and pointed out that the courts in California have been reluctant to adopt such a procedure because it's this idea of it would give the party who gets the agreement second and makes the choice I'm not going to sign, they get to have their cake and eat it too. That was what led into this discussion. I'm not meaning to argue that this was untimely.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anything in the arbitration agreement that says that the arbitration agreements themselves will only be enforceable if executed or signed by both parties?
No. The arbitration agreement says, by initially in the space below, says that multiple times, and then it says, we agree, we have read and understood the foregoing and agree to submit disputes arising out of the matters included in this paragraph to neutral arbitration. I don't dispute that Nevada Supreme Court precedent makes it clear that if a contract identifies a specific manner to demonstrate your assent, that specific method must be employed. If this contract said if you want binding arbitration, you have to spin around three times, clap your hands, and then sign your name with a big X, and somebody didn't do it, under Nevada precedent, you would not have an agreement to arbitrate. This agreement says multiple times, by initialing below, you are agreeing. By initialing below, you are agreeing. And then right above the initial blank spots, it says, we agree. To arbitrate.
They proffered it. Isn't that an indication that, look, this is what we want, you initial it, you agree, fine.
Taking that position would render the second signature blank superfluous. It would also create a dangerous precedent with respect to all, I mean, think of real property purchase agreements where you always have the two signature blanks. One party submitting an offer that might have a provision in there that says, do we agree to binding arbitration, and they don't initial that specific provision. Taking that kind of an approach, which is, well, if it's in their contract and they provided it, that would be a dangerous proposition, I mean, for all contracts.
Could you comment on the standard of review, specifically the fact that NRS 38247 allows for direct appeals of many orders in the arbitration context, and it is where a Uniform Arbitration Act state. Do other states entertain writ practice, and if so, what standards do they apply, whereas here you're seeking writ relief on an issue that has apparently been deliberately excluded by statute, presumably for the purpose of facilitating arbitration as a swift and non-complicated way to dispose of cases?
Just figuring out, I will answer that, and I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, but very quickly, the discussion you see in those cases always deals with application of the Federal Arbitration Act, and then in Nevada we have the Arbitration Act. They all say the same thing. You don't get to the issue of the Act unless, under principles of contract law that are determinative in that state, unless you have a binding agreement at contract to arbitrate.
I understand that, but I'm interested in the standard of review of us on a writ practice. In other words, is it irreparable injury for you to be remitted to arbitration that we should entertain, and how should we judge that, given that there was a deliberate exclusion from the statute of direct appeals in this context?
No, it is your classic to correct clear error and prevent manifest injustice. It would be manifestly unjust to force my parties down a path to which they did not contractually obligate themselves.
Okay.
That's where you see it all coming. And everybody likes to discuss the Federal Arbitration Act. Again, the cases say that you're moving two steps ahead. You got to first determine under basic principles of contract law of the state, was there a binding agreement to arbitrate? With that, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, whatever that may be.
Mr. Kimball.
Morning, Justices. May it please the Court. Brandon Kimball, on behalf of the real parties in interest here, the Aspen parties and Jeffrey Gwynn. John Bailey is with me. On October 10th, 2010, Aspen sought to compel 14 of the 17 plaintiffs in the district court case below to arbitration. Now, each one of those plaintiffs below had executed a loan servicing agreement. 14 of those plaintiffs below had specifically agreed to arbitrate matters like the one in the district court in arbitration.
So, Mr. Kimball, what do we do of the arguments being made by the petitioner in this case that if we were to allow this type of lack of execution or lack of manifestation of agreement to arbitrate, what do we do with the fact that we might be eviscerating the rule that there has to be some manifestation of an intent by the parties to participate?
I don't think that the court would be doing that, right? You start from the general proposition.
Let me pause you there, though. You omitted three of the 17 plaintiffs from your motion to compel arbitration.
Correct.
Why? Because they didn't initial that box?
Well, if you look at what the notice provision is for.
No, wait. Is that why you did not?
I think that's in part because we would have a difficult case showing anyone had agreed. Now, Aspen can certainly show through the execution of many agreements that it intends to arbitrate across the board. And as Justice Fairbury pointed out, it's our proffer. It's our document. That notice provision is not for us. We don't need notice of the arbitration provision.
So those three individual parties are carved out?
They're not the parties that we sought to compel to arbitration. They were carved out. But there's case law that we cited.
But they signed the loan service agreement, did not initial the box, and therefore you did not seek to compel arbitration as to them. Exhibiting, wouldn't you grant me, an understanding that if you don't initial it, you're not subject to arbitration, even though you signed the main line of the agreement.
I think it was an understanding that we didn't necessarily want to take on the different type of case that might be to compel those particular parties to arbitration. And there's a case we've cited, the Community Center of Vicksburg case, where that exact situation happened. The party that was being sought to be compelled to arbitration, they didn't initial an arbitration provision either. And the court went through an analysis and found that even though that party did not initial the arbitration provision, because they didn't specifically indicate some non-assent to the arbitration provision, that they were compelled to arbitration. We could have done that. But the case here is crystal clear with regard to these 14 parties who specifically initialed the provision. And as I was saying, that's because of the general proposition of law that signatures are not required in order to make an enforceable agreement. That is only required under Nevada law where the parties specifically make it so with unambiguous language. If you look at the language the courts are looking for, yes, there's no magic formula to what needs to be said by the parties, but they are looking for language, in the words of the Allstate Mortgage Court, that's too clear to be ignored. It's conditional-type language. It's the if language, when, subject to, only valid when type of language. There is none of that, as Justice Sater pointed out, in this loan servicing agreement, in the arbitration provision, and even in the notice section of the arbitration provision. There's none of that conditional language, the when, the if, that courts look for in order to find these types of requirements to make an enforceable agreement.
Well, that may be true with respect to a wide variety of other provisions in contracts generally, but the jurisprudence in the case of arbitration clauses, and more recently in the United States Supreme Court, which seems to have adopted some fetish in looking at arbitration clauses recently, looks at them independently and treats them as an independent segment of the contract. Why shouldn't we do that here instead of resorting to mutuality principles, meeting of the mind principles, and restatement principles that are focused on other contract provisions, not arbitration clauses?
Well, first, Your Honor, the petitioner has already conceded that general contract law is what's going to govern that analysis. And I don't believe the analysis would change if you were to somehow sever the arbitration clause and look at it independently. You still would be applying basic contract law to that. And those basic premises that we're citing here for the arbitration would still apply. Signatures wouldn't be required. You would be looking for specific language within the provision that required of the parties some sort of act in order to make it valid.
Well, maybe the petitioner is wrong on the analysis, and maybe I am, but indulge me if you would. Looking only at the arbitration clause, how is this court to conclude that that is an enforceable contract?
Well, you can...
Especially given this record where apparently there was no examination of anyone's intent.
I think the perfect case to look at in that instance is the Basura case that we've cited. It's almost factually identical to this case. You have a single party who sold homes to 48 buyers. They had a contract there that included an arbitration provision. It included the language that is very similar to the language that's used in our loan servicing agreements and in our arbitration provision. The seller there initialed only 20 of the 48 arbitration provisions. All of the 48 buyers initialed the arbitration provision. And the court there recognized the same principles that we're discussing here today. Everybody acknowledging that when the parties, I just wanted to read the words of the court, in their words, when it's clear both from a provision that the proposed written contract would become operative only when signed by the parties as well as from any other evidence would only be signified by signing it, the failure to sign the agreement means no binding contract was formed. Well, did the court look at that language and did they say, well, because you forgot to initial this provision, seller, there's no binding contract? They did not. They specifically...
Well, I appreciate that case, but my question is whether your record fits within that case.
Our record
in this case.
Our record fits almost identically within that case. What we
are
have,
there any contracts that Aspen signed?
Absolutely.
They initialed the arbitration clause?
Right. I can give you the rundown of what happened in this case. There were 17 plaintiffs, 14, everybody executed a loan servicing agreement. 14 initialed the arbitration provisions. Three of those parties who initialed the old provision, which contains a single line, but it says initials next to it. It's below that we agree language. 11 of the plaintiffs initialed the new version, which has the two lines. Aspen initialed five of those. And we set out a chart on page 15 and 16 of our answer that demonstrates there was no strategic incentive for Aspen, or there was no strategy implied by Aspen in executing those provisions. That, you know, in 2001 they may have executed an agreement and then not done it for another agreement in that year. And in 2006, you know, they initial the provision in October but don't initial it in December. There's no rhyme or reason to Aspen's initialing of those agreements. And like that Basura case, that court said it was fair to infer from that initialing of half of the agreements, or actually in that case less than half of the agreements, that Basura intended to be bound across the board to the arbitration provision. Well, Aspen does too, right? And their initialing of half of those provisions indicates that it did intend to be bound by those arbitration provisions, and it's really only a clerical error.
A point of clarification for me, it may not be relevant in light of some agency principles, but in those agreements where Aspen initialed the arbitration agreement, was it always the same person?
No.
No.
And if there were an opportunity to present this in the lower court, we certainly could present mounds of evidence of fully executed provisions by the Aspen parties, initialed provisions in the arbitration. If this court can't find from the record here, that I think is pretty clear that we intended to be bound across the board, like making the reasonable inference that the Basura court pointed out. I wanted to jump to the California cases here because you've been invited to look at three separate cases, and counsel tried to convince you that they looked at the specific language of that California notice provision that we've largely adopted in the loan servicing agreement, and that those courts found that language, that notice language, resulted in a dual signature or dual initialing requirement. That's not the case. First off, we've got the Grisura case that I told you about. They looked at the same provision, and they found no dual initialing requirement there. But the Phillips
case. They remanded it in that case.
What's that?
Didn't they remand it in that case?
It was remanded, and that's an option here. I think that is certainly an option. It's one we've requested. I think the record's clear enough here. One, that there's a lack of language in the notice provision that requires us to counter-initial the provision. I'm not standing here arguing that Aspen's not bound by that arbitration provision. We believe we are. We send it out. Again, it's a notice provision to the investors. If they execute it, we're bound by it. I wouldn't try to stand here and argue otherwise to you. With regard to the Phillips case, though, that case is probably the best example of the courts in California looking for some other type of language in the contract in order to find that dual initialing requirement. Specifically in that Phillips case, there was a clause in the contract. It was outside of the arbitration provision, and it said that every provision in the contract, not just the arbitration provision, that bore initialing lines would only be incorporated into the agreement if both parties initialed those lines. Well, the arbitration provision happened to be one of the provisions that had signature lines, but both parties didn't initial it. The court there relied on the language not in the arbitration provision, but in that special provision outside of the arbitration notice provision that required dual signature for a provision to be incorporated into the contract. And I think the Jim Shatakis case is a great case for us. If you look there, the principle's clear. It says that the parties can agree to some sort of specific act in order to find a contract provision enforceable. What language did this court look to there in order to find a signature requirement? It looked to language that said, this agreement binds the customer when it is executed by customer and Centel, and when it is executed by Centel and delivered to customer. Notice the multiple use of the conditional language when in that particular provision that the court relied on in order to finding a condition to enforceability. There's none of that here. And in fact, I think the best record I can cite for the fact that the language in the loan servicing agreement itself does not create this dual initialing requirement is the petitioner's argument in the lower court, where they admitted that the language in the old version of the loan servicing agreement, which is identical to the language in the new servicing agreement, itself does not require dual initialing. If you compare those two agreements, the language is exactly the same. There's none of that conditional language, and they admit below, and actually here in the response, that anybody who executed the older version is bound to arbitration. No dual initialing requirement. They're relying on the fact that there is an additional signature line. And the authorities that we cited in our answer make clear that the presence of just a signature line is not enough to create a condition precedent to enforceability. You have to
have some. Did your opponent argue that the contract under the new one as to arbitration was ambiguous as to whether mutual assent could only be manifested by both sides initialing? Did they submit it on this record as a matter of law that the court should read the contract and figure it out, or did they ask for a hearing that the court declined to give?
And that's an interesting point, Justice Pickering, because this issue didn't come up in any of the briefing that was before the district court on the initial motion until about the last 2 minutes of oral argument.
I didn't see it in the moving papers at all.
Because it's not there. It was raised by the petitioners below only on oral argument and through their arguments in reconsideration.
So this is a writ that's saying this district court acted in manifest disregard of the party's rights and abused his discretion in not further exploring the alleged ambiguity in this clause, yet nobody asked for an evidentiary hearing or to present further evidence as to the proper interpretation of this ambiguous cause?
Well, we didn't certainly didn't have an opportunity
you have no reason to
do that below. We didn't know this argument was even coming until oral argument, and we hadn't researched any of the authority. But that is precisely the case. Yes. Your Honor, if you look to the language here, there is nothing in the entire loan servicing agreement, the arbitration provision itself, or the notice provision that can be construed as clear, unambiguous language, creating a condition precedent that dual initialing is required prior to enforceability. It's not there. Any failure by Aspen to execute these agreements or initial these agreements was nothing more than a clerical oversight. It was not an expression of intent to avoid arbitration. And for those reasons, this court should deny the petition. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir Morris, I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice Sata. Justice Pickering, to make something very clear, the issue was briefed. It was not briefed in the initial motion. It was raised at oral argument on the initial motion. The oral argument, if you read the transcript that's provided in the record on appeal, shows that the vast majority of the discussion was related to whether this was a timely request.
Right.
Judge Denton wasn't focusing on any other issues. We filed a motion for reconsideration. Opposing counsel filed an opposition. Before our reply was even filed, the motion for reconsideration was denied. So it's not accurate to say this issue was not put in front of Judge Denton. It was put in front of Judge Denton, and Judge Denton denied the motion for reconsideration. So I don't want you to think that we're running around behind Judge Denton's back. He knows this issue was put in front
of him. But the standard for entertaining a motion for reconsideration differs from what it would be on the original presentation to him, correct?
Right, but you can't.
So you have to say he abused his discretion in denying your motion for reconsideration to get us moved to grant you writ relief, correct?
It was clear error. No, it was clear error. You cannot, a judge in the state of Nevada cannot enforce a contract that is signed by one party, enforcing that by the party who chose not to sign it. It's just clear error. I mean, if you look at basic contract law, that was
the I understand your point. It's a failed mutual assent. But their point is the contract's ambiguous at even crediting your argument. You don't agree with that.
I'd be fine with that because they drafted the contract. If you want to go back to, again, contracts 101, if it is ambiguous.
You didn't make that argument or tender it. Evidence on the issue of intent as to that ambiguity.
We don't believe it's ambiguous. We believe it's absolutely clear. But if what you're saying is, but they want to argue that their own contract's ambiguous, let them knock themselves out. It's their contract. So any ambiguity would be construed against them. What Mr. Kemble has done is he stood up in front of you and said that this arbitration provision, which has language that states by initialing below, you are agreeing to this. By initialing below, you are giving up your rights to this, and then has a provision that says we have read and understood the foregoing and agree to submit disputes arising out of the matters included in this paragraph of neutral arbitration, and has two signature blocks, did not tell the parties what they needed to do to manifest their mutual assent for the provision. The cases are clear. Signature by one party, the initial by one party on this contract constituted an offer to submit matters to arbitration. The refusal or failure by the other party to initial constitutes a rejection of that offer. It's just basic contracts.
So simple yes or no. Mr. Morris, your argument would necessarily cause us to conclude then that your clients could not seek to compel arbitration either.
Correct.
Thank you. Mr. Kemble, Mr. Morris, thank you for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted.